Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. From Ferguson to Boston, questions of race and racial disparities still haunt America. For example, just today, Boston Mayor Marty Walsh appointed the city's very first chief of diversity to try to make the city's workforce more reflective of the city's population. Meanwhile, some of the members of the city council want local colleges and universities to hire more minority faculty members. So the march toward racial equality is slow. And yet, Boston and the Northeast in general have long presented themselves as a model of racial equality. It was the home of abolitionism, a refuge for blacks fleeing Jim Crow South, and it's where people like Jackie Robinson and Massachusetts Senator Ed Brooke broke the color barrier. But historian Jason Sokol says the truth about race in the Northeast is more complex and troubling. He argues that despite post-World War II advances in racial justice, the Northeast has often turned a blind eye to patterns of segregation, discrimination, and racial violence. In his new book, he examines this complex history of race in the Northeast, including how a city like Boston can be both the cradle of abolition and the scene of race riots over busing. Jason Sokol is a professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. His new book is entitled All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. And Jason Sokol, welcome to Radio Boston. It's great to have you.
Thanks, Anthony. My pleasure.
And listeners, we'd like to ask you to join the conversation. Has the Northeast dealt with its complex history on race, or how do you think it has? Have we moved beyond busing? Are there still racial tensions that aren't discussed? Could unrest like we saw in Ferguson happen here? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. And Jason, I'd love to begin with you where you begin the very beginning of your introduction, right here in Massachusetts, with Edward Brooke, who grew up in Washington, D.C., moved to Boston after the war. He's elected attorney general, then senator. And you write, an African-American man winning 1 million white votes was the stuff of hallucinations below the Mason-Dixon line. But then you write, cities like Boston were simultaneously beacons of interracial democracy and strongholds of racial segregation. So first of all, you know, describe what you mean by that, by strongholds of racial segregation.
Well, I mean, in terms of spatial patterns, when you're talking about housing and schools, the cities of the Northeast are currently and have long been as segregated as any other cities in America. So that's what I mean by bastions of racial segregation, the sort of spatial patterns that are really entrenched where we are.
So how do you explain what you describe as these two warring stories of race in the North? I mean, on the one hand, a story like Edward Brooke, which is sort of a transcendent story about racial equality, and on the other hand, ghettos and racial disparity and, as you say, strongholds of segregation.
There are a couple different ways that I try to explain it. One is with reference to what I call the Northern mystique, which is an idea that I think Northerners have about their own region as being, as you said, the stronghold of abolitionists and the cradle of American democracy. I think at times that heritage and those lofty ideals have propelled Northerners to a higher place, have encouraged them to break color barriers with Jackie Robinson, with Ed Brooke, to welcome African Americans in a way they weren't welcomed and supported in other parts of the country. At the same time, white Northerners could use that mystique as a mask, as a way to obscure these patterns of segregation, as a way to say, no, we're committed to freedom and democracy, just as segregation festered in neighborhoods and schools and racism exploded through the streets.
You know, you mentioned Jackie Robinson, and you write really interestingly about Jackie Robinson, of course, the first African-American baseball player to break the color line in professional baseball, treated as a hero in Brooklyn, although complicated even in Brooklyn. But what I wanted to ask you about was when he and his wife, Rachel, tried to move to suburban Connecticut. They were treated really badly. Tell us what happened to their effort to buy a home in suburban Connecticut.
Their efforts began in the early 1950s. They were, at that point, living in St. Albans, Queens, which was an area where many upwardly mobile African Americans lived and owned homes, and the Robinsons wanted to pursue the suburban ideal, like many other Americans in the early 50s. They set their sights on various towns in Westchester County, New York, and Fairfield County, Connecticut. And inevitably, each time the Robinsons would put in an offer on a home or would call about it, whenever the realtor or seller got wind that this was an African-American potential buyer, all sorts of ruses would be employed. Oh, the home was taken off the market. The selling price went up. So they were treated firsthand. They had firsthand experience of how housing discrimination operated in the Northeast. And the stunning thing is that white homeowners didn't want an African American as a neighbor, even if it was Jackie Robinson.
You write, in fact, eventually they were finally able to buy a house. As you write, the Bridgeport Herald published a story about their struggles to buy a home, right? And eventually they were permitted to do so. But this was happening at a time when there were all kinds of bylaws, and you describe one in Greenwich, Connecticut, for example, the Greenwich, Connecticut Real Estate Board, that were overtly racist.
Right. That was just one that popped up in the Bridgeport Herald article that you reference, was the Greenwich bylaws. But many suburbs had similar bylaws that realtors expressly were forbidden selling homes to certain quote-unquote undesirable groups that would supposedly drop housing values. And when realtors were confronted with this kind of information, they would simply blame it on the next person. They would say, oh, well, I'm just representing my sellers, and there's prejudice in this community, so I'm not really, therefore, I'm not really responsible for it. And this is how racism often functioned in the Northeast, is one often passed the buck to the next person.
Yeah. So you write about Connecticut there, but of course this was widespread, as you suggest. There was redlining here in Boston. I mean, this wasn't an isolated thing. These were widespread housing policies that went all the way up to the way federal loans were administered, and they affected the way cities developed, right, in a big way?
That's right. That's right. It's important to also acknowledge the role of the federal government in this. As you say, Federal Housing Administration, Veterans Administration. This was the reason that many segregated communities developed, because there were incentives for whites to buy, and specifically for whites to buy in certain communities. So this is part of the story of how ghettos grew in certain places.
Yeah. To what extent has this complicated legacy been acknowledged by folks now, today? To what extent is it important, first of all? And I guess the first question would be for public officials. I mean, do you think folks have sort of come to terms with that?
I think there is somewhat a sense that the North has racial problems, but I think many Northerners still want to believe that the story of racial struggles is somehow tangential to our region's overall history, where everybody acknowledges that if you want to understand the South, you have to understand the legacy of slavery and segregation and Jim Crow. I don't think there's that sort of widespread acknowledgement in many parts of the North, and I think we could stand to have that.
Listeners, we're talking to Jason Sokol. He's an assistant professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. He's author of a new book, All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. And you can join the conversation about how the Northeast has dealt or is dealing with its complex history of race. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. And let me introduce Peniel Joseph. He's founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. He's a friend of Radio Boston. And Peniel, it's good to have you back on the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We like to hear from you about your reaction to Jason Sokol's thesis. What do you hear? What do you think? What's your reaction?
Well, yeah, I think it's important. I think that the overarching importance of the book is the fact that it builds upon some real great historical scholarship on race in the North and civil rights in the North, and the way in which that landscape is much more complicated than we think, and it weaves it together in a very, very interesting way, and also sort of recovers certain historical figures like Shirley Chisholm and Ed Brooke in very interesting ways, is providing a context for when you think about Deval Patrick and when we think about people like Barack Obama. Certainly when we think about northern racism, Boston and busing in 1974 really stand out, but there's so many other important tales in here. So I think that one of the overarching lessons for all of us who study the civil rights movement, study the movement of social protest in the post-war period, is that the North was not some kind of bastion of racial liberalism, even though, as All Eyes Upon Us depicts, often they were trying to portray themselves in that fashion.
Mm. Jason, I'd love just sort of picking up on what Peniel is talking about there. I mean, when you think about the kind of virulent and very on the surface and easy to sort of see and describe racism of the Jim Crow South, was the kind of racism, sort of post-war racism in the Northeast, I don't know, almost more sinister in that it was not as obvious, and yet it was there.
Some observers said, certainly some African-American observers said, that they were, in a sense, more comfortable in the South because they knew where they could go and where they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
That's an easy way of saying it. But oftentimes the North's racism was more hidden and covert, though there were also moments, for instance, the Boston busing crisis, where it was right out there and it was anything but subtle.
Yeah. Peniel Joseph, do you agree with that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think for one of the characters in the book is Ruth Batson, who's one of the foremost local activists for school desegregation in the 1960s and the 1970s. And she often describes, both in this book and in other studies, just how difficult it was to be African American in Boston in the 1960s. So for somebody like her and other school desegregation activists, Boston in the Northeast was extraordinarily difficult and really extraordinarily frightening. I think one of the best parts of the book is the description of Boston and busing and the violence that occurred in 1974, and really how the city reacted to that violence. And it was really starkly drawn along racial lines, and the reverberating political effects that had nationally in terms of Boston and busing, and the fact that the opponents of busing really were victorious, right? We live, the interesting part when you read this book, and it ends with the discussion of folks like Duval Patrick and the idea that the North rises again, and Barack Obama. But in the 21st century, we have resegregated ourselves as Americans, but we don't talk about racial segregation. Right?
Hmm.
So we have de facto, what people call de facto segregation, rather than de jure segregation. And it's a really stark reminder. And you talked about Ferguson earlier, and certainly whether it's Ferguson or Boston, this is really connected to decades-long public policy that's at the federal, at the state, at the local level, and that policy intersects with housing, with public schools, with prisons, some of which are talked about and discussed in this story as well.
Well, Peniel Joseph, I know you've got to go, but we're really grateful to have your input in this segment, so thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's Peniel Joseph. He's the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University. And Jason Sokol, let's talk a little bit about busing, because you write about it really eloquently in this book, and I'd love to just sort of get a little bit from you on this. Again, we've talked about this a lot on this show. Obviously, Boston has been talking a lot about the 40th anniversary of busing. But how does that, in your view, how did this sort of difficult history of busing in Boston represent this thesis of yours, or define that thesis?
Part of my book is a story of the North from World War II to the present. And for me, the 1970s represent the fall of the North, where in this vapor of racial strife interracial ideas sort of evaporated and dissolved. And so I think the busing in the larger story, the busing crisis represents to me the low point of this larger story of race in the Northeast. Now, what I tried to do was, my idea is that the perspective of whites in Boston has been given a lot of attention by Common Ground and many media reports. And likewise, the perspective of African-American activists is starting to gain more attention, as Peniel mentioned, Ruth Batson and others. I write about NAACP leader Tom Atkins. My idea was to look at what Ed Brooke thought about busing, and his position really resonated with me. Brooke was, of course, the only black senator in America at the time, and he was representing Boston and Massachusetts, which was the hotbed of anti-busing sentiment, and Brooke came out in favor of busing.
Interesting. Let's take some calls. We've got a lot of folks on the line who want to chime in on this conversation. Let's go to Michael, who's calling from Roxbury. Michael, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. Thank you, and congratulations on the book. I am basically first generation raised in the African-American community of Boston during the 70s. I participated in the MECO program, which is the other desegregation program. And from my experience as a historian, is that the major problem and why this will never go away is that black history is not adequately taught to white students or black students. And so you have a great degree of ignorance on both sides about the influence and the impact of the Africans on this country, even to the point where a lot of African-Americans without that information of knowledge can't adequately contribute the way they should because they're in a politically charged environment that is dumbing them down and convincing them that they do not belong. Hmm. And it is a real, it's a real subtle cancer that I've been seeing just going on for years growing up and just, you know, witnessing the dynamics that has gone on in my city. And then just the people that I've grown up with and being bused out in the suburbs and just the ignorance that I witness on both sides because of the lack of understanding of history.
Hmm. Michael, I'm really grateful for you putting this idea on the table, and we're going to come back to it in a minute, but I want to take another call or two just to sort of take the pulse of what people are thinking out there. Let's go to Jonathan, who's calling from Danvers. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say I grew up in western, very rural Massachusetts, and my experience has been, first, I completely agree that I think that racism in the Northeast is, they seem to insulate themselves. For example, I didn't even realize until I got into college out in the Boston area just how much I had not been raised with any kind of diversity. I grew up in a very white community. The Western Mass, for example, was settled largely in the 19th century by just groups of poor Europeans looking for the American dream. And so the racism there is just, it's very deep-rooted, and I didn't even notice. I think we don't even realize that we're racist until we get out into the bigger world and see that, oh gosh, wow, didn't realize this was even a thing.
Hmm. Well, Jonathan, thanks for that thought. And Jason Sokol, let me come to you because there are two calls in a row there that sort of get at the same thing. I mean, the first caller talking about a lack of understanding about black history, and Jonathan there talking about a lack of diversity, which sort of leads to the same kind of issues around ignorance and not quite understanding the world as it is. What did you hear from those calls?
Well, I think that Americans' common impressions of the North, they don't think of the North and immediately think of racial struggle,
yeah,
or immediately think of civil rights, or immediately think of slavery or segregation. In reality, the North has had all those things, and the North's history of racial struggles has shaped it as a place as much as anywhere else. That's, I mean, clearly slavery was not as central to the North as a whole as it was the South, but New York City was built by slaves, you know. So I think in order to reckon properly with our region's past and our country's whole past, and I think what the callers are suggesting, one also has to reckon with the North's unique and distinctive racial history as well.
I want to ask you about something that you write about as well. I mean, you remind us that there are have been, and it started happening in the post-war era. African-American mayors were elected in the Northeast, not here in Boston, not yet anyway, but in Philadelphia, New York, elsewhere. Of course, we have a black president. So what's the significance of this? I mean, how far does this kind of change at the top of the political structures solve the sort of problem of this, of coming to terms with this complicated racial history?
Right. There are some things that it does and some things that it doesn't. I write about Thurman Milner in Hartford, who was the first black mayor elected in any New England city. And Milner, for all of his efforts, could not change the fact that Hartford was becoming a city with more and more racial minorities and more poverty. And I think that points up the problem that many black mayors have had. David Dinkins is a story in my book. But one thing that the African Americans in position of power does, there's a few things that they do that's important. And one is that it changes the minds of whites as well as African Americans to see a black person in the job performing it ably. I think that's a profound change from the rest of American history, the fact that there is an African-American president. Is Obama able to solve the chasms between African-Americans and whites? No. Is he able to decrease police brutality? No, it seems not. Or African-American incarceration? It seems not. But still, I think Americans growing up in this era, it's different. I interviewed Deval Patrick, and he had similar things to say. He thought, you know, it does change. He felt that it changed the minds of African American youth and also of white Americans in ways that I don't think we should underestimate. Though at the same time, I would not say that this solves all of our deeper structural problems.
Yeah, to use the sort of hackneyed phrase, it hasn't propelled us into a post-racial society, not yet anyway, right?
It certainly hasn't.
Yeah. Well, let's go to Matt, who's calling from Watertown. Matt, you're on the air.
Yeah, I was just calling to say that I recognize one parallel that I think represents kind of what we're all talking about, and that's in sports, whereas you can look at the Boston Celtics, you know, a team that was one of the first NBA teams to integrate itself, and Red Auerbach led that, and you have Bill Russell statue that was recently installed. But then, you know, the contradictory story would be the Boston Red Sox, which was one of the last teams to integrate, and until the ownership changed. So I think that really shows that contextually you can have people ready to make that jump and to live in a post-racial America versus, you know, others that won't. And I think that the only way to combat that is to create more contextual evidence and more situations where, like, the I don't know who the gentleman, but where he noted that
Jason,
you know, when
Sokol,
more black men in power, you know, you're going to show that there's evidence that this is a possibility.
All right, Matt, thanks a lot for reminding us of those two. I mean, Jason, talking about those two warring stories of race in the North, Matt's point about the Celtics and the Red Sox is a kind of nice one.
It is, and it's true. Bill Russell as a player coach on the one hand, and on the other, the Red Sox, the very picture of sports racism. However, I would point out that Bill Russell once called Boston a quote-unquote flea market of racism. So although Russell himself was able to ascend high in the Celtics organization, I don't think he found this to be a sweet land of liberty or a promised land.
Mm. I've got to ask you about sort of some of the current news and what it gets you thinking about. I mean, the case in Ferguson, we've been using this line a lot, from Ferguson to Boston. Of course, the big story was out there in Missouri, but there were hundreds of people protesting in the streets of Boston just a few days ago. What does the Ferguson story say about race relations in America, in your view, and in the Northeast, even?
Well, I think the Ferguson story is, to me, a sad and sobering story. I write about how America and the North, as you say, have had two stories at war with each other. Inside our own national soul, we carry this history of segregation and racism, and we carry it with us no matter whether we're in Massachusetts or Mississippi. And on the other hand, we carry this possibility for multiracial democracy and interracial democracy. What Ferguson says to me is that, sadly, the more sobering story seems to be winning out, at least at this moment in time, despite the fact that Obama's in the White House, despite all the other progress one might cite, and the string of killings over the past couple of years, killings of African Americans, brutalizations, suggest to me that the progress side has not won out.
Well, sobering thought to leave us on, but a really, really important and interesting thesis. Jason Sokol, thank you so much for coming in. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's Jason Sokol. He's assistant professor of history at the University of New Hampshire. His new book is called All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, co-creator and former head writer for The Daily Show, Liz Winstead, on the intersection of politics and humor. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.